This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There was a time when the elderly and the terminally ill died at home. Over the past 50 years, advanced medical technology has offered the possibility that death could be delayed or prevented by hospitalization. But recently there's been a movement toward bringing dying loved ones back home so their remaining time can be spent outside the institutional atmosphere of the hospital or nursing home. Advances in home-based medical technology and changes in insurance reimbursement have contributed to this trend. No matter how committed you are to caring for someone at home, the responsibility can be overwhelming and frightening. My guest, Andrea Sankar, is a medical anthropologist and author of the new book, Dying at Home, A Family Guide for Caregiving. It's based on interviews she conducted with men and women who took care of loved ones dying at home. In a little while, Sankar will tell us about her own experiences taking care of her dying mother. Sankar says part of what is involved in the decision to care for a dying person at home is the desire to allow that person to live out life in as normal a way as possible, to have the experience of living while dying.
Well, I think when people are dying at home, it gives them some sense of control over what's left of their lives. It also gives them the sense that they're still alive. I mean, when they're in the hospital, they're a patient, and when they're a patient, that means that they give up some aspects of, you know, who they are, like their ability to say no when somebody comes into the room, or their ability to wear their own clothes or eat the food they want. And they do that with the idea that they're going to get better. That's sort of a bargain they make with the hospital. But when they're at home, they don't have to give up any of those sort of aspects of personhood, because they are in their own home and they're in control again, and they're able to live out the rest of their life as much as possible.
Did you find that a lot of the people who you spoke with who had family members die at home, did you find that they had certain fears of having someone die in the house?
People who hadn't had someone die in the home were often quite frightened by it. People were often very influenced by things they'd seen on TV. I mean, they imagined that there was going to be some ghostly light appear, or a cold wind, or sometimes very irrational fears. Or they thought the death would be quite gruesome. I mean, they thought of images of Hollywood, and they were extremely frightened by that. And one of the things that a hospice, you know, a trained hospice person can do is to be there with you when the dying is taking place. There's nothing, you know, it is not a supernatural occurrence. A death is something that's within the normal range of behavior. I mean, you may not have seen a death before, but there's nothing that's going to happen that is somehow totally different from what one would expect. But not knowing what to expect or not knowing what can happen, it can be very frightening. And so one of the things I did in my book, one whole chapter, is it consists of death narratives with the caregiver describing exactly what happened when somebody died, so that people can see that, you know, it can be very, you know, it is not that frightening. It is, however, and this is significant, it's not always the case that people slip into a coma and die in their sleep. In fact, that only happened in one case. You know, it tends to be the case that when you leave a hospital with somebody and you ask the physician, use the caregivers, ask the physician, what will happen when so-and-so dies? Physicians tend to say, oh, they'll slip into a coma and die quietly. That very rarely happens. You know, people are very often awake when they die, and they can be frightened, and you can be frightened, and there are things you can do to reassure them, you know, and make that death much more peaceful. But it's not the case that they just sort of die in their sleep.
In your book, you write that we used to know how to sit with the dying, and we're forgetting how to do that. Explain what you mean, since we still do sit with the dying, although it's often in the hospital during visiting hours as opposed to at home.
Well, what I mean by that is we don't really know how to take care of the dying. You know, we don't know what needs to be done with them. We don't know how to be the main source of comfort for them. In the hospital, you can sit there and hold their hand and talk with them, but you often are the one, you know, you often let the nurse do most of the, you know, comforting and straightening and attending. A great deal of caring for somebody who's imminently dying, say, you know, within 2 to 3 weeks of death, is simply comfort measures. It's helping them to eat what they can eat, what little they can eat. It's helping them to keep their mouth moist. It's helping them to, you know, keep their bodies clean. A lot of that is very basic nursing care. It's sitting with them when they can't sleep at night because they're frightened. It's, you know, it's maybe giving them a massage. It's things like that people, because they've given over that sort of, you know, folk knowledge to hospitals, they don't know how to do it anymore. And those are the things people need to relearn.
Well, you know, that reminds me, when we're talking about bringing a dying person home, what are we talking about in terms of the amount of time that they have left to live, and how much time you would be called on to be a full-time caregiver? And in your experience and in the experiences of the people who you interviewed, how much time did the dying person have left?
Well, you know, I should say that there are dying people who don't go into a hospital before, you know, they're not all discharged from the hospital home to die. There are people who, you know, have stayed at home most of their terminal illness. But the intense time period I'm thinking about, the period that I call active dying, is, I would say, really about 2 months. Up before that time, people can be very sick, but they often are somewhat ambulatory. I mean, they can walk, they can take care of themselves to some extent, so they don't need your intensive care. I would say 2 months is really at the outside. It's more likely 6 weeks to a month where you can be doing intensive round-the-clock nursing care. And the thing people have to remember is that when a dying person is in the hospital, they may be in an intensive care unit. They're definitely on a hospital floor where they're able to get 24-hour nursing care. When they come home, you're the person who's giving them that 24-hour nursing care. Their needs don't change. You know, one of the striking things about this experience, and it sounds a little ironic, is that the dying person is very, very sick. I mean, sicker than you can ever imagine unless you've been in that situation. And they require a tremendous amount of care.
So it really is quite a sacrifice for someone to care for a loved one at home who is dying.
It is, but I want to say two things about that. One, almost all the people, except for one person who did it, said it was probably the most important thing they'd ever done in their life. So it is a sacrifice, but it is it's extremely rewarding. The other thing I want to say is unfortunately, given the way health policy is moving, which is to have less and less care in the hospital, or to have shorter and shorter hospital stays, combined with dramatic advances in medical technology and pharmacology so that more and more care can be given in the home, it's entirely possible that within the next 10 to 15 years, it won't be really, unless you have an acute problem, it won't be possible to die in the hospital. That whether, the caregivers like it or not, the choice will be either dying at home or dying in a nursing home.
If you're just joining us, my guest is medical anthropologist Andrea Sankar. She's the author of the new book, Dying at Home, A Family Guide for Caregiving. When you're caring for someone and that person has died, then what happens? Who do you call? Who do you call to take away the body?
One, you don't want to call 911, because if you've prepared for a home death, when you call 911, all they will do is come and try to revive the body. So many hospices suggest that you wait until the body is actually cold. Now, some people want to have the body removed right away and feel that they have to have the body removed right away and will call a funeral home and have them come out. I found in my study that if people who allowed the body to stay in the home, say 6 to 8 hours, had a much easier time saying goodbye to the person and resolving their conflicts. They treated that time, they were able to go in, be with the person, spend some time, maybe some friends came over, people who've been involved in the caregiving were able to come over and take a very intimate, personal goodbye with a person. And also if children had been involved, children could view the body in the sort of the privacy of their home. That period, allowing that period of time, seemed to make a great deal of difference to people rather than having the body taken away immediately. After a certain point of time, they were ready for the body to leave. It wasn't like they wanted to have the body there all the time, but at a certain point they said, okay, now it's okay for the body to go. But they did want the body to remain there for a while, and they felt much better about it. One of the benefits of having a home death is that you can make an arrangement with a funeral director before the person dies. So the funeral director is expecting you to call. And in many cases, now this varies by state, but in many cases, a physician can sign the death certificate before someone dies, and you just fill in the date so that you don't even have to have a physician come out. If the hospice nurse is there, of course, the hospice nurse can help you with all of this, but you may not have to have the physician come. You may be able to keep this just a completely private family affair. And when you feel that you have resolved, you're ready to say goodbye to the person completely, then you can call the funeral home. There's no need to rush it.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest, Andrea Sankar, is a medical anthropologist and author of the new book, Dying at Home, A Family Guide for Caregiving. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Andrea Sankar is my guest. Now, I was interested to find that in your study, of families who cared for a loved one at home that you had a very broad definition of family. You're just not talking about blood family, nuclear family.
Absolutely, and that's an important point. I'm glad you brought it up. By family, I mean any group of people that come together and think of themselves in a very responsible, caring relationship. And this is particularly important when we're talking about HIV-positive people, because the AIDS, people who have AIDS, those people often are estranged from their family of birth, and the people who care for them become family to them. Those are their informal caregivers, their colleagues, their lovers, their companions. And I my book is about those people too. I mean, it's about any kind of people who provide that intensive, extremely committed care to a dying person.
Now, you cared for your mother when she was dying. This was in 1987. How did you make the decision to do that?
We really didn't consider anything else. I mean, I'd worked in home care for so many years. I knew sort of what the issues would be involved, and I knew the kinds of things we could expect. And when it became clear that the hospital couldn't help her anymore, we just felt seriously that she should be at home with us. And, I didn't know how difficult it was going to be, but we didn't consider any other options.
What was she dying of?
Cancer.
You say you didn't know how difficult it was going to be. What surprised you the most?
The sheer physical exertion it took. I mean, I think it's staggering. In many cases, dying people don't sleep. They don't sleep. They sleep in tiny, tiny naps. They're afraid to sleep because they're afraid they won't wake up again, so they don't want to sleep. Also, in many cases, which was the case in my family, the dying person can have brain metastases, which means that their cognitive functions are impaired. They say crazy things and they maybe behave in a crazy way. Also, that can be an after effect of the medication, so that they can be very irascible. So that you're continually, it's very difficult to sleep. It's almost impossible to get good help to come in and work at night. That's the most difficult time to get staffing. In addition, then one of the ways, of course, that people stay alive is through eating and drinking, and that becomes more and more difficult. So that you can sit by a person's bed with a tiny baby spoon with just a drop of food on it and try to get them to eat, or try to get a little bit of liquid into their mouth so that they can live. And the dying person may really want to live. And in my case, my mother was, when she was coherent, was determined to live and wanted that, but nothing tasted good because she had so many lesions in her mouth from the chemotherapy, so that we were continually trying to find something that she could eat, something that she could drink. And it was extremely frustrating, but it would take literally hours to get maybe a little Dixie cup of food through into her.
When your mother was disoriented, were there periods that she wouldn't even recognize you?
No, she always recognized us, but she would be very angry sometimes, and then later on she would apologize. And that was very upsetting, given how much energy my family and I were putting into taking care of her. Then she would lash out at us. And that definitely is one of the aspects about taking care of a dying person, is that the social niceties tend to disappear. I mean, people are very honest. And if you can't tolerate that intense emotional intimacy and sort of raw emotions, it's probably not a good idea to be a part of this. So that whatever feelings she was having were very present, and we had to deal with that. And sometimes that wasn't so easy to deal with.
Well, what you really want in a situation like this is someone who is endlessly appreciative of the sacrifice that you're making by caring for them. Not their anger.
Right, but you often get their anger, and you get the other stuff too. I mean, but there's something there's something very refreshing about the complete honesty of it. I mean, you're at such a bare bones kind of survival, frontier almost in your life, that there's something extremely powerful about that honesty. I mean, you feel like you're in a completely different state, and you are.
Did you find yourself talking about things with your mother that you had never talked with her before?
Well, she was having enough trouble dealing with her death herself, and she was cognitively disoriented enough. I mean, there were periods when she would be immensely clear. But there were other periods when, we just couldn't talk to her. And I'm sorry. I mean, I'm sorry that didn't happen. I know other people did have that experience, people I interviewed, and were really able to have very deep probing discussions and clear up a whole lot of aspects of their past. And that was quite wonderful, but we didn't do that.
Did she want to die
no.
at home?
Oh, die at home? She didn't want to die at all. I mean, she wasn't really willing to accept that. She very much wanted to be home, and she was extremely grateful when she got home. And that, you know, the relief and the pleasure in her voice when, you know, she finally arrived at our house was really worth a lot, because she'd been in the hospital for a long time.
What were some of the difficult medical decisions you had to face when she was home?
You know, that's one of the aspects of this whole process that is extremely important, and somehow it's difficult to talk about. You, as the caregiver, you're the person on the front line, and when somebody is that fragile, you can make the decision that could, in effect, end their life. I mean, they're so delicate. You don't know from one day to the next whether the medication you gave them, you know, the day before is the right medication to give them, that dose is the right medication to give them now. And you could potentially do something that could end their life. And now you have support. You have nurses that you can call all the time or can come out, but they can't be there every minute. So I found myself continually making decisions that were far beyond what I considered my competence. And I learned a lot. I learned a lot very fast. But it was an incredible responsibility, and that was frightening.
Give me an example of the kind of decision you're talking about.
Oh, for instance, she would be very agitated, and she wasn't in any pain. So we would argue, my sisters would argue for the fact that she should have some medication that would reduce the medication, that if she'd been in pain, the narcotic effect would have reduced the agitation. So we would try different kinds of drugs to see what would potentially reduce her agitation. But the difficulty with trying, we tried different sleeping pills or different tranquilizers and, you know, things like that. But the difficulty would be that we could give her something that was so strong that her body couldn't tolerate it, and potentially could reduce her ability to breathe. Or another problem would be that because of these lesions in her mouth, some of the medications we tried could cause her excruciating pain. So there was this trade-off between, on the one hand, trying to reduce her agitation so that she would be more at peace with herself, and on the other hand, worrying about the side effects that some of these medications that we gave could create. We had a very frightening thing happen soon after we brought her home to the from the hospital, in which we reduced one medication inappropriately because of some bad advice we had, and she almost died from that. And so, you know, we were very conscious of just how delicate the balance was.
Were you with your mother when she died?
She waited. My sister and I were taking turns checking on her every 15 minutes because she'd become dramatically worse. And she waited until I had left the room and died between the time that one of us, we were out of the room. We weren't there that exact moment.
Neither of you were there?
No.
You think she wanted it that way?
Yes, I believe she did. And in fact, in almost all the cases that I interviewed, people describe similar things. Either the dying person waited until everybody was there or waited until nobody was there. They seem to be, and a lot of research seems to show that the dying person exercises some level of control over that moment.
Can I ask how you felt about her waiting until you left?
You know, the whole process, I mean, the very end of her death was so traumatic for me that I didn't particularly react to that moment. The whole last period was pretty, I think she suffered a lot in the end. And I didn't, that particular factor that she had, you know, when somebody dies, when they're that sick, it's hard to say exactly when they've died, in a sense. I know that sounds awkward, but there was a point at which her respiration stopped, but there was a process in which there was less and less of her there, and more of her had passed on to a point where she wasn't there. And it really was more of a transition than a final point. I mean, I felt a day and a half before she died, she became suddenly much more clear and, you know, alert than she'd been in weeks. And we had a wonderful talk, and we sort of all had this great talk with her, and she was like completely like herself. And I felt that was the period in which she sort of said goodbye to us. And then from then on, it was really like this transition where there was less and less of her present. And so at that exact moment didn't mean that much to me.
Do you think that it affected the mourning process for you to have been with her during the last weeks of her life?
Well, I think it affected it in two ways. One, I think I had thought I would be less grief-stricken when she died than I was, because I'd been so close to the death process. And many people you know, many people said that too, that caregivers were startled that they were so grief-stricken because they thought they were sort of dealing with their grief by being part of the caregiving, and none of us were. You know, it was very dramatic for all of us. So in that sense, it didn't help. But in the sense that it did help was that I had so many supporters, so many friends and colleagues and family members around me during this process of caregiving, that process of feeling very, very taken care of by my friends and community really helped me later in adapting to my grief.
What room did you give your mother when you brought her home?
We were fortunate. We had a study in our house, which had, you know, very large windows in it, and so we were able to put her in that room so that she had a lovely view to the outside.
How long did it take you after her death until you felt like you could use it as a study again?
Oh, maybe a few weeks. It wasn't that hard. I mean, for some people, one or two people I interviewed, it was more difficult, but it wasn't that hard for me.
Would you say that your experiences taking care of your mother brought you closer to the rest of the family, or were the difficulties such that they brought out differences and conflicts?
Well, in my family, it definitely brought us closer. I mean, I think, you know, it can go either way. It can, you know, if there's a desire to work out conflict, a situation like this can really, you know, it puts things right on the line, and it can bring a family much closer together. On the other hand, if those conflicts can't be resolved, there are many cases in my research where family members haven't spoken to each other since the death.
Hmm. Well, Andrea Sankar, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Nandra Sankar is a medical anthropologist and author of the new book, Dying at Home, A Family Guide for Caregiving, and she heads the medical anthropology program in the Department of Anthropology at Wayne State University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.